here today. I'm Jennifer Shoemaker. I'm a professor of psychology. I'm at Abilene Christian University, which is a little far from here. So it's been nice to be here.
I was
going to give you a little introduction to why I'm interested in this topic. So I'm a school psychologist and worked in public school district and in international schools for about 6 years as a school psychologist with kids from 3 to 21, which is kind of the range that we see in the public schools. 21 is usually our kids that are struggling and, you know, having trouble getting out of school. So a lot of kids who just aren't thriving, who are having a hard time doing well. And I worked with that population before I came into working at ACU as a professor. And so then I started working with we have a master's program there in school psychology and helping people who are getting ready to be school psychologists and go out and be in schools think about how do we work with these children who aren't doing well? How do we help them learn how to thrive and support them in that? So that's kind of what got me interested in this particular topic and working with children and adolescents. And then also I'm a mom. I have three daughters who are at this point 15, 13, and 11. They just keep getting older. I don't know how that happens, but I feel like they were just babies yesterday. But, you know, that also as a mom is a totally different thing as well because now it's not just my students that I'm working with, but it's my own kids that I'm seeing and their friends and thinking about what are the things that are happening in their lives and in the context in which they're all living now that are presenting challenges to them. To help them thrive, what do we need to do to make that work better? So that's what I wanted to talk with you about. And today we're going to start with challenges to thriving. What are the things that get in the way of thriving, and what does it mean to thrive? And then tomorrow I'm talking about strategies, so you have to come back. Today is going to be sort of the, hard part. But then tomorrow we'll talk about, so where do we go from here? How do we help them move forward, and what are some things that we can do from different perspectives? So from a family perspective, from a church perspective, from a community perspective, what are the things that we can do to support the children and the adolescents that are in our lives? So that's what we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes. And I thought I would start us off with this verse because I think this is so appropriate for the kinds of conversations that we'll be having today. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride and possessions is not from the Father, but is from the world. You know, we live in the world and we're inundated with messages. They're really different about where our value comes from, about what's important for us to be and to become. And so our kids are hearing this too. And there are some specific challenges to them that are different than those that we faced when we were growing up than even 10, 15 years ago. So I work with college students now. The things that my 15-year-old and 13-year-old are dealing with as teenagers are different than some of the things that those students that I work with who are in their 20s even dealt with, because the world has changed in a lot of ways. So we'll talk about what are some of those changes and how do we support our kids in dealing with that. So before I move into that, let me ask you guys, what age groups do y'all work with? Are there people here working with young children? Middle school? Okay, high school as well? What about college students? Okay, so we have a full spectrum. So I work with the sixth grade girls at my church, which I think is such a pivotal age. Anyone work with sixth grade? That's such an interesting time, right? Because they're moving out of being children, but they're not teenagers yet. You know, and in some ways they're still very childlike, but in other ways they're not. And also, even within the group, you have people who are at all different developmental levels. So middle school is particularly challenging and interesting. I love working with them. But it is unique. And then we have high school where they're kind of moving and growing into their own selves in a different way. So I wanted to just give you some examples of some of the challenges that our kids are facing. The first one is sexualization. This is something that I study a lot as a professor, so a lot of the research that I do is looking at sexualization of our culture and how it impacts children. In fact, I have a book that came out in February about this, and they have it in the bookstore, and I'm signing books tomorrow before my session at 1. At 1, I'll be signing, and then we'll have another session at 2:30. So come by if you want to take a look at it. But this is, you know, the kind of images that they're seeing that are getting put in on their radar in lots of different ways. One of the things is, and we'll talk more about this in a second, but a lot of those kids have these in their hands, even in fifth grade, fourth grade. So the kind of images that most of these are advertisements. Those kind of images that I might have just seen when I was growing up, like in a magazine or maybe on a billboard or something, these kind of things are coming into their homes now and into their lives in a different way. It's more pervasive. I wanted to give you a few examples of this. So these are some of the kinds of marketing that are targeting our younger kids. So this is starting really young. This one over here, it's a onesie that says, "Dude, your wife keeps checking me out." You know, like, that's a baby. Why are we joking about sexuality with a baby? Kind of the same with the chip magnet. You know, this image right here. This little girl, at the time that image was taken, was probably 8 years old, 7 or 8. And you have this photo that's very sexualized, reminiscent of something from, you know, a swimsuit issue or something like that. So these kinds of images are coming into their world and are influencing them and focusing on your value coming from this very sexual perspective and also what you look like and how you can attract people. Now this, if you work with adolescents, these are the kinds of images that are targeting our adolescents. When I put these up, even for my college students, when I put images up like that, they're always like, ugh! You know, they're shocked by them. And I said, you know what? You should be shocked and you should be offended. But this is what your kids are seeing. This is what they're being targeted with, are these kind of images that objectify the girls and women, that make them into sexual objects, that focus on boys and men as being sexual aggressors. You know, so it is offensive, and we should look at it and go, ooh. When I went into, these are all Abercrombie, American Apparel. These target adolescents. Even our middle school kids start wearing these clothes. And so when I went into a store with my daughter, my oldest daughter is 15 now, and she was, I don't know, probably 13 or 14. She wanted to go into Hollister. Have you guys ever been into that store? These images are all over the place, giant on the wall. Well, I didn't know that because I'd never been into one of those stores before. So we walk in, and I saw that, and I thought, I'm not buying anything in here. And we left, and I said, we're not giving these people our money, but we had to talk about that. Why are we doing that? But this is the kind of stuff that they're seeing. And when we talk about sexualization, what we mean is, the idea that a person's value comes from their ability to attract other people and make them into a sexual object. So this isn't about healthy sexual development, right? You know, where people are learning about mutual respect and making choices that you want to make for yourself and being involved in relationships. And no, this is all about objectification for the girls and aggression for the boys. So that's some of the stuff that our teenagers and adolescents are seeing. And then moving along with that, one of the things you may have noticed is there's this big focus on fame as a life goal for adolescents and even children. And one of the things that's really interesting in the research about this, that it talks about how until about 2007, if you ask children, you know, what's one of your main goals in life? They would say things like success in my work. Some of them would say money, you know, being in a relationship. But until about 2007, they didn't say fame. I want to be famous. They didn't say that. It was hardly ever mentioned. But now, it's one of their top 10. And what do you think about the kind of things that are in children's lives right now. What do you think might be driving that shift? I would love to hear some of your thoughts on that.
You know, if you put something out on social media, it could go viral, and then all of a sudden you get famous.
Yes. They hear about these just regular people, right?
Right.
People just like me who suddenly become famous.
You too.
All that social media. Anything else? So we have social media that's moving that idea forward, this strange kind of thing, right? That's different. There's also things, I don't know if you guys are familiar with things like Hannah Montana, iCarly, those kinds of shows that kids who are adolescents now grew up watching when they were younger. Those were about people who were just regular people but who became famous somehow.
Well, and some of those actors and actresses literally became famous,
right,
too.
Yeah. So. They also are now famous. So
right.
It's like this strange kind of focus on fame. So we said the other thing is like reality TV shows, you know. So again, people who don't really have any specific talent or skill that they would be well known for are suddenly famous, and just people know who they are. So there's a strange focus on fame for its own sake. That's pretty new for kids.
Uh-huh. Hasn't fame always been there? Like the varsity football player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a varsity football player, but he's there as the quarterback, he's the captain of the team, because of the fame that goes with it and the power that's associated
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, but I think that's a different level. Like, you would call that social power, and it would be with people you really know in real life. This is fame, like, writ big. Like, everybody knows who I am, who I don't even know in person. So it's a shift away from social power within my own group of people I know face to face. Yeah, it's moved out of the peer group and into this large group, which is different. And they now say, that's one of my goals in life. And that's really different than it used to be. So it might be popularity, but that's a shift away from, it's really about expanding who knows you and even what you're famous for. So with popularity, that might be people like me. Fame isn't even really about being liked, right? Some people are famous for being unlikable. So it's a strange kind of goal. And I put some of these pictures up because I wanted to show you these three across here. You brought up social media, so these kids had posted pictures of themselves. There's this Instagram tag. It's like rich kids or rich kid life, and people, our children, adolescents, are posting pictures of themselves and kind of these conspicuously consumption situations. So you could see, like, these are ones that these teenagers posted of themselves. Look at me, look how much I have, that kind of thing. And this has become something that kids aim for, that they want. And I wanted to, so I moved, my next one was social media, because this is huge right now. How many of you guys are on social media? What kind of platforms are you using?
Facebook, Instagram,
Twitter. Instagram, Twitter,
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, Vine. These kids now they have all kinds of different connections. And what's interesting too is it's constantly changing, right? Because new ones come up, and so like My 13 and 15-year-old would not be caught on Facebook because right. their grandmother is on there. You know, no way are they interested in Facebook. They do Twitter and Instagram, and then there'll be something new that comes up. And we were just talking the other day because I try to keep up with it because I study social media and how kids use it. So I'm always asking my kids, you know, what are the new ones? And there's always something new. There's always a new platform. But this is a new challenge because you're connecting. You used to, you know, you would know the kids you went to school with and maybe the kids that you met at camp or you played football against or, you know, you would have these connections. But they were generally face-to-face kinds of connections. I met that person or I wrote to that person like a pen pal or something. So these are like pen pal on steroids, right? You've got all these different people. You don't even really know who these people are. So you're connecting to people. And I've had to have this conversation with a lot of adolescents. Just because someone says they are another 15-year-old girl doesn't mean that's who they really are, right? They can put a picture up that they got off of Google, and they Googled an image, and they put it on there, and that's their profile picture, but you don't really know who that is. And this is especially challenging because we who are working with children and raising children, we didn't grow up with this. And so sometimes it's even hard for us to anticipate what might be difficult about this. What do you think some of the challenges with a lot of social media use are for kids today? What do you think some of those challenges might be?
Bullying?
Yeah, this takes bullying to a whole different level. And you have people who can bully you or who you can bully. You don't even know who they are. You've never even seen them. And it moves it outside of the hours of school, which might have been, used to have been a safe time for a child who was being bullied. Now it isn't. In fact, it's probably worse than during school because there's no one watching.
Mm-hmm. It's very pretentious. I mean, you can shape yourself to look like whatever you want to, basically.
Yes.
No real reality.
Yes. We talk about that in psychology in terms of image management. So, have you guys ever met someone who you know online but you've never really met face-to-face and then you meet them and you think, that person doesn't look like I thought they looked, you know, because they've probably been filtering their pictures and using Photoshop and things like that. And so they're presenting this image, not even talking about like their likes and dislikes and talents, but even just their physical image is not what they really look like in person. And so you can do this strange manipulation and management of your image. Uh-huh.
Well, not only are you managing your image, there's really interesting research about how you're managing your conversations. Because
yes.
in an online conversation, I have a chance to delete and edit before I send it. And so there's a connection between that and then, or a disconnect between that and them actually having face-to-face conversations because of the anxiety that presents them because they don't have that ability to then edit.
Yes. That is a huge challenge right now. And it's a big challenge for especially early adolescents who are starting to form relationships with people who maybe they just got, like, say you're going into high school. You get to high school and you're meeting all these new people. And you can text with that person. Yeah, I don't really know you, but I'm kind of interested in getting to be better friends with you or getting to know you. And so you do all this editing that's different than if you and I just sat down and were having a conversation, right? I'm changing the way I'm responding to you. Maybe I was talking to one adolescent about this who said, I'm just so much funnier on text than on Twitter. I'm like, yeah, because you're like reshaping your message over and over again. Instead of just having a natural conversation. And so she was feeling anxious about actually interacting face-to-face with someone who she'd been texting with and talking to through computer mediation, right? You know, and that made her really anxious because she's like, I know it's funny when I can't edit myself. Oh, the pressure to be funny all the time or witty all the time instead of just talking. So that is a different kind of challenge than than kids maybe 15 years ago even faced.
And along with that, they develop their own online personality.
Yes.
Maybe totally different than who they really are so that they can look cool.
Right. Yeah, so part of that shaping one's image and shaping one's identity online, it could be very different. When we talk about computer-mediated communication, one of the things we know is that people tend to not just edit themselves, but they tend to communicate differently. So they might share what we call hyper-personal, too much information with someone you don't really know. But they also may be able to express themselves in a way that's different because this is kind of anxiety-provoking for them. So somebody who's maybe naturally shy or doesn't have as good of social skills, instead of building those social skills, now they might just form a lot of online relationships. I'm not sure that's really, I mean, psychologically, is that really a good idea to start having most of your relationships be formed in that way online, you know? So that's one of the things we have to ask ourselves is when they're doing all of this, what are the kinds of challenges that are being presented to them and in their ability to form relationships? And do things like develop social skills and learn how to read other people and learn how to communicate clearly with other people in a way that doesn't have to always be edited and that you're not expecting. So if I want everyone to think I'm fine all the time, what does that mean about the way I'm thinking about you when we're interacting face-to-face, right? I'm also thinking, he's not so funny, you know? He's not so interesting when we're talking face-to-face. That's a lot of pressure because, right, none of us are. I mean, everybody is going to have their moments when they're not so interesting, and that's what relationships are. And so these are kind of some really different kind of challenges that our kids are facing that we just haven't had to think about. And then we have consumerism. Now, one of the things that I've seen in the research that I've done is how much the marketing budget has grown for companies advertising to kids. And it is in the billions of dollars. It's just exploded because they've been identified as a target market, which is different. They have buying power, which is different than it used to be. It used to be, okay, I'll target the parents because that's who has the money. But now marketers look at children as the people who will influence the buying decision. How many of you have seen that commercial? I can't remember which car company it's for, but it's for a minivan. And the person brings the van into a like show and tell situation, and they're showing how you can open the doors in the trunk. Have y'all seen that commercial? It's a commercial aimed at children for a minivan. So that tells you those companies know that those kids are going to have some kind of influence on the kind of car that their parents buy for the family. So you see that kind of growing. There are now marketing plans from what they call cradle to grave marketing plans. So I'll give you one example is Disney developed this Disney baby line, and they started going into maternity wards and sharing information about the Disney baby line with mothers who had just given birth. I've had three kids. I don't want anybody in there, you know, trying to sell me stuff. Leave me alone. I've hardly slept, you know. But that's the kind of thing that they're seeing. So their kids are being targeted in a new way, and that's different in the past probably 10, 15 years than it used to be. So kids have been growing and growing and growing as a market force. Also, the other thing I wanted to point out, I don't think I have a picture of this one, but companies are getting involved in schools and kind of commercializing the school. Have you guys seen any kind of school commercialization marketing in the schools? Has anyone noticed that?
Channel One or something?
Yes, yes. So they have this educational, you know, kind of TV that you can play for kids at school, but it's got marketing in it.
Well, even usage when it comes to what we have in the classroom today, iPads,
right.
Apple, I mean, a lot of that's subsidized.
Yeah, and because they gave it to you or they gave it a cheaper, so I'm going to choose this over this. Things like Scholastic have partnered with Mattel, and so they're, when you go to like a book fair, there's also other things for sale that aren't books. Pizza Hut used to do what was called a Book It program, which, and there's lots of companies that do this. The more that you read, you get some kind of prize. Well, that's marketing. And so you're seeing them, I didn't put a picture of this, but you're even seeing them start to say, well, why don't you put this snack, you know, machine in your school, and we'll pay you this percentage of, you know, whatever, the amount that's paid, and it's got a big sign on it, you know, for the company. And they're selling their products there. So you see that kind of commercialism creeping into the school in a new way, and there's actually a lot of research now looking at kind of the commercialization of schools, because we all know that education funds have been cut, right? And so, you know, everyone's looking for extra. Okay, well, let's name our you know, stadium after you because you gave us money. We've all seen that with sports stadiums. And then the last thing that I wanted to point out is a challenge. So we have, you know, the sexualization. We have the technology components of social media. We have commercialization. But then we also have just more awareness of the violence in the world and the pain that's going on, partly because of, I was talking to a friend of mine right before this, and I said, you know, a lot of this actually is linked back to technology because there's so much more awareness, because there's so much more access. When I was a kid, if I wanted to know what was going on in the world, I had to, like, stay up till 10 and watch the news. And my parents didn't let me stay up till 10. And we were doing stuff during 6 o'clock, you know. We were out doing our sports or whatever, so we weren't going to be watching a 6 o'clock news. Or I had to read the paper, but I didn't usually read the paper. So a lot of times I might not hear about all of this stuff. So things like, you know, this is the Ebola breakout. That was a huge thing that kids were thinking about and talking about. You know, celebrities who are involved in domestic violence disputes, and, you know, the release of those videos, those kids see that. They're looking at that. War, kidnappings, you know, all that kind of stuff is something that is going to be in their lives and in their awareness in a different way than it would have been before, especially because of our changes in technology. So my friend and I, as we were talking about this, I was telling her, you know, I love technology. There's a lot of great stuff about technology. It can bring people together. I've met people who I wouldn't have ever met before if I wasn't able to connect with them. I've learned new things. But there are also challenges that it presents for our kids. And so, you know, that's the kind of patterns that we're going to see them struggling with. Any questions or thoughts on that? On those kind of challenges and patterns of challenge?
I think in some ways this one, the more awareness thing, can be a good thing, though, because it opens people's eyes to what greater than their own.
Yeah, it kind of expands their worldview, which can be a good thing. But one of the hard things is if I'm a kid, I'm a 12-year-old, and I have one of these, and I'm watching videos about the Ebola outbreak. If I don't have a place to go and talk to an adult and do some processing about that, I don't know what to do with that. And so one of the things, even though it can be a positive, is when we think about emotionally, a lot of times those kids aren't equipped to deal with the heaviness. And if we aren't thinking about the fact that they're getting access to this, we may not think to talk to them about it. I have to be really careful with that. I have, you know, two teenagers in my house. Young teenagers, they do stuff like that. They'll ask me questions about things that I think, oh, how do you know about that? You know, and I know how they know about it. They heard something and they went and looked it up. I have to be so aware of the fact that they're exploring some of this stuff that when I was that age, I wouldn't have even known about. So it's not necessarily bad, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge for us as the adults in their lives to think about how do we help them process this and use it in a positive way. So then I use this verse to kind of transition us into thinking about what can we do to help the children and the adolescents in our lives respond to these challenges. And I really love this because I think one of the main messages we want them to get is this idea that, God is with you and God is greater than all of this. And that if you have safe people that you can turn to who are people of faith, they can help you learn how to build your resources and to process this kind of stuff. And so that's kind of my transition. I wanted to briefly introduce you to this idea. Because I'm a psychologist, I think in terms of theory, and so one of the theories that has really helped me as I work with kids is, this is Bronfenbrenner, and it's called the bioecological theory. And what the bioecological theory tells us, the bio part is about the individual. So you see in the very middle, it starts with the person. And I know that the kids that I work with as individuals have their own strengths, they have their own weaknesses, they have their own experiences that they're going to build on, and I can help them build those experiences. And then we have these systems that influence them. So the microsystem, this is those systems that are closest to you, so like your family, your close peers, your school group, your neighborhood, your church. So those systems are really important in building my skills and learning how to process this, all of this stuff that's going on around me. And the kind of resources that I get from those systems are really going to help me to either thrive or not to thrive. And so we really want to think about those systems. I'm going to skip the mesosystem because that's really just how all of those systems interact with each other. So how the school and the home interact. And then you move out into what's called the exosystem, which is things like mass media. This is the school, like the larger school. Your workplace, so this could be the school district. And then the macro system, which is just culture in general. And the reason it's important to think about that is because what we're going to move into next is thinking about how do we build strengths or assets within the child and their communities. So these kinds of microsystem pieces that help them thrive, because we don't always have a lot of control over what's going on in these bigger areas. Those are kind of where our challenges are coming in from. So what do we do to build some assets and some strengths so that they can respond to those in a healthy way? So I wanted to lay that out to kind of give you a perspective that I'm going to be thinking about when I talk about how we do that. In psychology, there's this idea called positive youth development. And it's really just a framework to understand how systems in a child's life either help them respond to the environment in a positive way or don't. So we'll be talking about that framework today, just kind of laying it out. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about strategies. How do we build these assets? So the core idea is really with this, that the individual child has strengths and that the systems that they're living in, like their school, their home, their community, their churches, there's some strengths there. And how do we harness those to help them move forward? So these are just some of the systems when we think about that. Our family. And you guys are working with children, so you know this. But some families have more internal strengths and resources than others to deal with these kinds of challenges. Awareness, education about these things, time, because if, say, you're a single parent who's working two jobs or something because you're struggling with poverty, that resource is going to be a little different for you. The church, I think, is a huge component here. I did some interviews with adolescents a couple of years ago, and I asked them, when it comes to popular culture and the kind of pressures that you feel from popular culture, who do you talk to about that? And they said, each other. And I said, that's great. You know, one 13-year-old is getting advice from the other 13-year-old about how to process some of the stuff they're seeing. So I said, well, would you like to have other people? And they said, yeah, we'd like to talk to our parents about it. We'd like to have church conversations about this. With my sixth grade girls last week, we talked about all the stuff that's been going on with shootings and police and, you know, all that stuff, because that's in the news and they're hearing about it and they're thinking about it. But they haven't really had a chance to sit down and just talk about it, especially from a faith perspective. And so this can be a huge place where we can play a part in building these resources. In psychology, we would call those ecological developmental assets. That all that means is, what are the strengths that are within those different contexts? So the family, the church, the school, the community, their peer group even. So if we can build that up within the peer group, that's really going to help, because our goal is just to increase the resources within that system. And that's what's going to help the child thrive, because they have more support, right, from each place that they're looking for it. So building these resources is huge. And for me, as a psychologist, I think one place that we can really do better with that is our churches. Because I'm a member of a church community, and I've talked with kids about their church communities, and there are lots of times when they're wanting more of those kinds of conversations and supports. So being able to build our resources there is important. So tomorrow we'll talk about some specifics about that, but I wanted to give you information about just what does thriving mean from a psychological perspective. So when we're looking at what does it mean to thrive in positive youth development, these are the 5 C's that we'll look at. So there's competence, confidence, character, connection, and caring. My students always get tired of me talking about the 5 C's, but it's really important, because if we know what those are, and that when I build these resources within these, I can help that child thrive, that's a really an easy way for me to remember that. So I'm going to leave that up there for a second, and then I'll talk about what each one of those means. But the 5 C's is an easy way to remember that. So let's look at those. What do those mean? When we're talking about competence, what we're talking about here is having a positive view of your actions in specific areas. And it can be any of these things. But what's really important to think about is what does that child think it's important for them to be competent in? What matters? Because you can be competent in lots of different areas, right? But do you feel like you are competent in ways that really you think matter? And the communities, the families, the peer group, those are the ones who are going to help them figure out what those things are. So I'll give you an example going back to sexualization. If an adolescent thinks, as a girl, the most important thing for me to be is sexually attractive and to have lots of people who want to be in romantic relationships with me. Not even talking about if they're sexually active, but if that's their main goal, their competence is going to be focused on how they look, on how many people like them, on how many people are interested in them. That's not really a healthy place to be focusing on your competence. But if they're involved in a lot of sexualized media, that's the message they're going to get. So we have to make sure we're sending a different message to them. That we're talking to them about what is it important for you to feel competent in it? What makes you valuable, really? Things like your character, like how you treat others, like that you're a child of God. You know, those are the kinds of things that we want to help them learn how to focus on So this is going to be an open question. Is they're going to be looking for competence in something. We all know those kids, don't we, who decided to be the best, you know, criminal that they could be or whatever. They choose those things that you think, oh, that's so destructive. But they, for some reason, have hooked into that as being valuable for themselves. So we want to help them think about building the idea of this is what's important for me in a way that's healthier. Confidence, this is kind of just their overall self-worth or self-efficacy. We use that word a lot in psychology. And really what we mean by that is believing that I can, that I'm valuable and I can affect change. So this isn't about competence in certain areas. This is just my overall belief in myself. And so we want to be asking, how do we build that? And tomorrow we'll start talking about some of those ideas. How do my interactions with this child, how do our interactions as a community or church body help build their confidence in who they are and who they were made to be? Well, I'll just tell you one little thing that's a strategy, but in case you don't come tomorrow, you'll get one. But with our sixth grade girls, one of the things we've started doing is talking about spiritual gifts and start helping, because they've never thought about that in relationship to themselves. I'll ask them every time I say, how many have heard spiritual gifts? You know, everyone raises their hand. How many of you have ever thought about your own spiritual gifts? Nobody. They've never thought about that. And so as they're emerging into their own selfhood, especially in early adolescence, helping them start thinking about, what are your gifts? What are your strengths? How can you use those to serve other people? How can you use those in the church body? You know, those are kinds of things that are really important and that help build confidence and their ability to do something in our group that they've never thought about before. So that's one kind of small piece that we can start thinking about. Then, of course, we have character. This is really just respecting cultural norms, a sense of right or wrong, knowing what those are. What that means is, number one, we need to be talking about that. And so I want to go back to that idea of the girl and the sexualized media that's telling you, oh, the most important thing is for you to be pretty and to have people be attracted to you and have a lot of romantic partners or sexual partners. If I've never talked to them about this issue, talk about sexual behaviors, sexual attitudes, if we're not having those conversations at home or at church, where are they going to form their opinion? If they're getting all that media message, that's, and their friends and who are also getting all those media messages and aren't having conversations, then that's where they're going to start forming their opinions. So to help them have a bigger conversation, it's really important that we talk about that stuff at home. And not just with sexuality. I mean, all of these issues, consumerism, consumption, how we treat other people, violence and war problems and things like that. All of those things we need to be helping them think about and talk about. One of the things in my studies that I've done with families is that I found that parents are really reluctant to talk about sexuality and even these other hard topics. So as churches, maybe that's one thing we can do too, is help those families figure out how to do that. And then I just wanted to quickly, connection, this is building relationships. We'll talk about that more tomorrow, how we can do that in our body, our church bodies, and with our families and communities. Because remember, all those connections they were building through social media? So it's important that we help them think about this. How do I build positive relationships and make sure that the relationships I'm in aren't tearing me down? And then lastly is just caring. Learning how to demonstrate caring behaviors toward other people and build relationships. That goes with that connection one in a lot of ways. Building relationships that are positive and show compassion for other people. So those are our 5 C's. And when we come back tomorrow, we're going to start talking about how do we use those to move our children forward to develop strengths And we can talk about that from a church perspective and a family perspective. Any questions before we end our time together? Thoughts, comments?
You said you were doing a book signing. What's the title of your book?
It's called Sexualized Media Messages and Our Children. It's a long title. Teaching kids to be smart critics and consumers. So part of what I'm talking about tomorrow is some of that. Like, what do we do to help them, empower them, and give them skills? Because we may not even know what all those are because it's so different than when we grew up.
Where's your book at?
It's, well, they have it downstairs, but you can also get it on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So that'll be tomorrow from 1 to 2, and then I'll be back in here again tomorrow at 2:30 talking about the strategies. Anything else? Other questions? Well, thank you for being here today. I appreciate you, and I hope you come back tomorrow.